Okay, we're in Acts chapter 23 tonight. Acts 23 is a little review. The Apostle Paul has just finished three very successful missionary journeys, and he has one more journey to take. And this is going to be a journey that he takes as a prisoner all the way to Rome. Now, if you remember what happened in Acts chapter 22, he came back to Jerusalem, went on to the Temple Mount to worship, and a mob broke out because they said he brought Gentiles on the Temple Mount. And that was the one word that would stir up the crowd, Gentile. Gentile, there's a Gentile, there's a Gentile. So they just rushed upon Paul and they were about to, you know, just kill him on the spot. Roman soldiers who were up in the fortress Antonio and could see all this, they came down and they rescued Paul and found out that he was a Roman citizen. So suddenly he takes on new status. If we want to kind of get a running start there, chapter 22, verse 30. The next day, since he, the commander, wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews, he released him and instructed the chief priest and all the Sanhedrin to convene, and he brought Paul down and placed him before them. So here is Paul before the Sanhedrin. You've probably heard this word Sanhedrin many times before, because Jesus appeared before the Sanhedrin on the night before he was crucified. The word Sanhedrin just simply means sitting together. The Jewish Sanhedrin was a group of leaders that led the Jewish people after they weren't allowed to have a king. You know, the last king of Israel occurred, you know, in 722 when the Assyrians conquered the northern kingdom. And then the last king of Judah, as we're reading right now in 1 Chronicles, happened, you know, there in 586 B.C. And then after that, there was never again a Jewish king. There hasn't been one since. They've always been under the control. You know, when they returned from Babylon, they were under the control of the Persians, later under the Greeks, later under the Syrians. There was a brief period of time there, about 163 B.C. during the Maccabean Revolt, when they had a little bit of self-governance, but never did they have a king again. And so this Sanhedrin, this group of, could be anywhere from 23 to 70 Jewish elders, leaders, they comprised sort of the governing body, but they weren't the government. They were only the religious authority, because, of course, during this time and during the time of Jesus, Jerusalem and all of Israel was under control of the Romans. So this was a religious authority made up, as we're going to see in a moment, by both Pharisees and Sadducees. All right, now we're in chapter 23, verse 1. First thing we're going to talk about is in verses 23, 1 through 5, the Sanhedrin and Paul. So let's read about this. Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin, and he said, "Brothers, I have lived my life before God in all good conscience to this day. The high priest Ananias," now don't get this guy confused with Annas, the high priest, and Caiaphas, who were alive during the time of Jesus. This is about 17 years after Jesus appeared before the Sanhedrin. So this is a different guy altogether, Ananias, who was the high priest. He ordered those who were standing next to him to strike him on the mouth. Wow, pop him in the mouth. Why? Well, what was offensive about what he said? "I've lived my life before God in all good conscience to this day." So I think that Ananias was just trying to show he had the authority to have somebody smack Paul in the face, and so he did. I love Paul's reply, verse 3. He said, "God's going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. You're sitting there judging me according to the law, and yet in violation of law, you ordered me to be struck." That's more than just an outburst. It's actually a prophecy, because guess what happened to old Ananias? Just a few years later, at the first Jewish war against the Romans, about 63 A.D., the Jews did, they killed Ananias. He was one of the first ones that the Jews killed, because they saw him as one of the pawns of the Romans. And so, yes, God did strike him dead. And of course, he called him a whitewashed wall. What is that talking about? Well, it's kind of an expression that also Jesus used. If you remember in Matthew 23, when Jesus was talking about the scribes, the Pharisees, the chief priests, he said, "You're a bunch of whitewashed tombs. On the outside, you look all clean and proper and pretty, but on the inside, you're full of evil and corruption and decaying flesh." So an idea of a whitewashed wall is like a wall where somebody has maybe spray-painted graffiti that's obscene, and then somebody just goes over and just kind of whitewashes over it with a thin veneer and a cover. So what Paul's saying is, you know what, Ananias, you're really evil and wicked, but you have this outer veneer of being righteous or holy, because he was the high priest. Now, several things about the Sanhedrin and the high priest, I could kind of give you a little insight. The Sanhedrin met in a special building that was attached to the temple called the house or the court of hewn stones. Because hewn stones meant that they were stones that were actually shaped or hewn by an iron implement, and none of the blocks or the rocks in the temple itself had been hewn with an iron instrument, and so this was called the Court of Hewn Stones. For those of you that maybe have read Jerusalem Protocol, the book I wrote about the rebuilding of the Third Temple, they also built the Court of Hewn Stones. And today, according to the Temple Institute, you can go right online or go YouTube, and you can find the architectural plans for this Court of Hewn Stones. Because the Jews have formed another Sanhedrin, and they're planning to meet sometime in the rebuilt Court of Hewn Stones. The high priest was a position that was elected by the Sanhedrin, but you know what? It's like it's all politics. You could elect somebody, but if the Romans didn't approve it, you know, no good. It had to be like, okay, we elect this guy, but the Romans have got to say he's our man. So Ananias was one of the Sadducees, we know, because the Sadducees, they were the ones that were in cahoots with the Romans. The Pharisees hated the Romans, considered them, you know, interlopers, intruders in their land illegally. But the Sadducees, they went along with the Romans. And so that's how you became the high priest. Sometimes it was bought, but always approved by the Romans. He said, "Your whitewashed wall," this is there in verse 3, "you're sitting there judging me according to the law, and yet in violation of the law, you have me struck." Verse 4, "Those standing nearby said, 'Do you dare revile God's high priest?'" Now, I want you to think a little bit about Paul's answer here. I'm not real sure. "Oh, I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest," replied Paul. "For it is written that you must not speak evil of a ruler of your people." Now, you know, I wanted to kind of dig into that, so I read several commentators on this, and most of them agree that maybe Paul's being a little sarcastic here. It seems like all of a sudden he's this real humble, nice guy. No, he's not really. That's not his personality, and I mean, he doesn't recognize this as a man of God. So most scholars believe that he's just using a little sarcasm now. "Oh, I didn't realize that I was talking to the high priest, the man of God. And the scripture says you should not dishonor, you know, the man of God." So whether he was being truly humble or sarcastic, we don't know, but that's his answer. And so that worked for him. There's another interesting theory about this. I'll give you the third theory of why he did what he did and said what he said. You know, there's a pretty strong belief that the Apostle Paul was suffering from some eye problems, because, you know, he wrote to the church at Galatia, and he said, you know, "You love me so much and overlook my wounds, and you would have even given me your eyes if you could." Now, this is after he was stoned at Lystra and Derbe. So maybe either he had eye vision problems, or maybe his eyes were terribly injured. So there's even one theory that he's there before the Sanhedrin, but he can't really see who this guy is that's talking to him. So that's That's another theory about that. So we'll have to wait till we get to heaven and say, Paul, why were you so nice to Ananias? You know, you were right the first time. God was going to strike him down. All right, then we come to chapter 23 and verses 6 through 9. And this is what I call Paul's brilliant strategy. To me, this is one of the most amazing moves that Paul ever makes. He's being as wise as a serpent, but as harmless as a dove. And I want to use it as an example. Have you ever been watching a movie, maybe a war movie or a spy movie, and you know everybody's in a room, and suddenly somebody pulls a pin on a grenade and rolls the grenade inside the room? Everybody kind of acts differently when that happens, right? I mean, they start scrambling, they start moving, and it just, everything goes crazy. Sometimes that can happen conversationally. You know, have you ever been in a setting and everything's good, everybody's happy, everybody's getting along, and somebody kind of rolls a conversational grenade into the middle of the discussion, and then everybody gets all upset and they get active and, you know, they just begin to act totally different. That's kind of what Paul is going to do here. And to me, it is a brilliant strategy. All right, let's pick up with verse 6. When Paul realized that one part of them were Sadducees and the other part were Pharisees, he cried out in the Sanhedrin, "Hey, brothers, I'm a Pharisee, the son of the Pharisees. I'm being judged because of the hope of the resurrection of the dead." Pull the pin out. Roll the grenade in, stand back and watch what happens. When he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit, but the Pharisees affirmed them all. The shouting grew loud, and some of the scribes in the Pharisees' party got up and argued vehemently, "We find nothing evil in this man. What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him?" Now, you know, here's Paul on trial, and suddenly he introduces this one concept, resurrection. "I'm here because of the resurrection." And all of a sudden, both sides jump up, and they start arguing and screaming at each other. And Paul just kind of slips into the background. You know, no longer is it about him. He has introduced a subject. I think this, it's important for us to know, you know, who these guys were. Sadducees and Pharisees. Why? Because, you know, we see them often all in the life of Jesus. These are basically political slash religious parties. There were three major Jewish religious slash political parties. The third was called the Essenes. And the Essenes had so gotten disgruntled with the whole scene in Jerusalem, they had just left town. They had gone off into the desert to live. They're the ones that copied the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Essenes. So you had these two parties left over, and really, folks, we can make some comparisons today between liberal, conservative, left, right. You can put whatever Republican or Democrat name you want to put to either of those positions. But you think there's hostility today in our nation or in Washington, D.C.? It was much worse during the time of Paul and during the time of Jesus. These guys really despised each other, and they had total different sets of values and beliefs. So what about these Sadducees? Well, you know, one of the things that Alexander the Great and then the ones after him and the Romans wanted to do, they wanted to introduce the Greek mindset, philosophy, education, culture. It's called Hellenization. Why is it called Hellenization? After Helen of Troy. They wanted to just make the whole Roman Empire Hellenistic. And although they spoke Latin, Greek was the widespread language, the Koine Greek. That's the language the New Testament was written in. They wanted everybody to dress like Romans or Greeks. They wanted everybody to speak Greek. They wanted everybody to adopt those customs and build their houses in the Greek style. And the Sadducees said, oh, yeah, we're on board. We'll do that. And so they wanted to be more Greek, and they wanted to be less Jewish. I mean, they sort of thought of all the Jewish customs and Jewish styles as being old-fashioned. You know, these were sort of the progressives, you might say, you know, the cutting edge. We want change. And so consequently, the Sadducees didn't believe in, like, the supernatural. They didn't believe in angels. They didn't believe in any of the miracles of the Old Testament. And they didn't believe in the resurrection of the dead. Now, that's why, if you remember, one of the questions that the Sadducees asked Jesus was, they told the story, you know, of the woman whose husband died, then she married his brother, then married seven more brothers, and they all died. And then their question to Jesus was, in the resurrection, whose wife will she be? And the funny thing about that is they didn't even believe in a resurrection. They're just trying to trick Jesus. And to them, it was nothing but a joke. And so when Paul introduced this idea of resurrection, I mean, it was a divisive point because these Sadducees didn't believe in it. They didn't believe in an afterlife. They didn't believe in heaven or hell. You know, I often said that's why they were sad, you see, because they had no heaven to look forward to. You've heard that a million times. All right, the Pharisees, no Greek. Oh, we're not gonna adopt any Greek dress or culture or customs or speech. You know, we hate anything Greek. We are more Jewish, and the more Jewish we can be, the better off we are. You know, and so their emphasis was on the law, but not just the written law. If you remember, they were really into all the oral laws. And they were the kind of people that loved to go to parties and stand there and judge other people. You see him? Yeah. Her? Yeah, look at them. Look at the way they're dressed. Look at what they're doing. They're the ones that accused the disciples of Jesus of not washing their hands before they ate. And it wasn't a matter of hygiene. It was a matter of ritualistic cleansing of the hands a certain way. The Jews still do it today. And they were the ones that got angry at Jesus because his disciples, they picked wheat and ate some of the grain on the Sabbath day. They were always the ones picky on rules and laws. And of course, they did believe in angels, resurrection, heaven and hell. So when Paul comes out and says, hey, you know what, I'm a Pharisee, I'm the son of a Pharisee, and the reason I'm being tried is because of the, here's the grenade, resurrection. And they start all fighting between one another, and they basically forget about Paul. So that's why I call this a brilliant strategy. And so the Pharisees come to his aid. Okay, now let's go to verse 10. And we're going to see where Paul is, 23:10, rescued again by the Romans. Rescued by the Romans. Now, I told you again, if you could kind of look at the temple with the entire Temple Mount, the hall of hewn stones was built right about here. And over here was this huge fortress of Antonio with its towers, so that they were much higher in elevation than the Temple Mount, so the Romans could always stand up here and look down and watch what these pesky Jews were doing. So once again, they hear this mob scene. They hear these guys screaming at each other. And let's pick up there with verse 10. When the dispute became violent, the commander feared that Paul might be torn apart by them and ordered the troops to go down to take him away from them and bring him into the barracks, which means back here into the safety of the Roman fortress. Now, did you notice it says it got violent? I mean, these guys weren't just, I want you to try to picture this in your mind, all these long robe guys, some of them wearing Greek outfits, some of them wearing the old Jewish outfits. I mean, they're throwing things at each other, throwing books at each other, scrolls at each other, picking up their stools and throwing them at each other. I mean, it is a wild mob scene, all because Paul just rolled that grenade in there. That's all about the resurrection. That's what we're talking about here today. So they rescue him. And then, to me, one of the most beautiful parts of this entire chapter is there in verse 11, where we see Paul reassured by Jesus. You know, I love the fact that several times from here to the end of Acts, the Lord Jesus is actually going to send a word of assurance and comfort to Paul. And let's pick up in verse 11. The following night, the Lord stood by him and he said, "Have courage." It's a word that literally means cheer up. And in the original language, Paul's name is used, but not in every manuscript, but in many of them. He says, "Hey, Paul, have courage, cheer up. For as you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so it is necessary for you to testify in Rome." You know what Jesus was saying? He was saying, "I'm not through with you yet. You know what? You may think things are bad now, but don't worry. You're going to make it all the way to Rome. And guess what? You're not going to have to pay your fare. The Romans are going to pay your fare and all your meals and lodging all the way to Rome." So Jesus did two things here. You know, literally it says it stood by him. Jesus stood by him. So I take that literally to mean that there was some kind of a physical manifestation of Jesus there in that jail cell with Paul. Where else do we see Jesus stood? You remember when Stephen, that first martyr, died? He said, I see the heaven open and I see Jesus standing at the right hand of God the Father. But at this point, he wasn't standing at the right hand of the Father. He's standing there in that cell with Paul. You know, Paul spent a lot of time in jail. I mean, he's going to spend the rest of the book of Acts basically as a prisoner, okay? And many times when he was in jail, God delivered him out of jail. Remember Philippians, Acts 16? Shook the cell, set him free, set Peter free from the jail cell. But, you know, in this case, he did not deliver him from the jail. So here's a kind of a lesson we can apply to our lives. You know, sometimes when we're in a tough situation, we want the Lord to deliver us out of it. And he says, "I've got something better for you. I'm going to join you in it. I'm going to come be with you and stand by you as you go through this trial. And guess what? I'm not finished with you yet. You're going to make it all the way to Rome." I always think about what happened years ago on one of our mission trips to the former Soviet Union, to the Crimea. There were quite a few of us from Green Acres, and we were flying Aeroflot Airlines, which is literally a wing and a prayer for sure, emphasis on prayer. And we hit some very bad weather, very turbulent air. And, I mean, the plane was bouncing around, and I just remember one of the ladies in our group, she just kind of grabbed my arm and said, "Oh, Pastor, I'm so afraid that we're going to crash and die." And I said to her, you know, that's not going to happen because I don't believe God is finished with me yet. And she said, "Yeah, but what if he's finished with that guy over there on the other side?" Just spoiled a great spiritual lesson there. But obviously we landed and everything was fine. And it was like God says, you know, "I'm not through with you yet." That's what he said to Paul. And he not only stood by him, but he spoke to him. You know, I love that. These are. In your Bible, these are red letter words, meaning these are the very words of Jesus. And he's saying, "Cheer up. You know, you've already done a good job testifying for me in Jerusalem, and now I'm going to let you preach the word in Rome." So maybe the Lord is standing by you in your time of adversity and trouble, and maybe he's saying to you, you know what, hang in there, cheer up. It's going to be okay. I love that word, cheer up. It's used several times by Jesus. It's the same word he used when he said, "In this world you will have tribulation or trouble, but you know what? Cheer up, take courage. I have overcome the world." I just want to introduce kind of the next thing that happens after this. In verse 12, we see this Jewish plot against Paul. And this is pretty crazy. When it was morning, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves under a curse not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. There was more than 40 who formed this plot. Now just imagine this. There were these Jews who were so zealous for their Jewish purity in the law that they made a vow. We're not going to eat. We're not going to drink until we kill Paul. Verse 14, these men went to the chief priest and elders and said, you know, we bound ourselves under a solemn curse that we won't eat anything until we have killed Paul. So now you, along with the Sanhedrin, make a request to the commander that he bring him down to you as if you are going to investigate his case more thoroughly. But before he gets near, we are ready to kill him. By the way, you know what? The chief priest, Ananias, who now was no fan of Paul, apparently agreed to do this. So here's the scenario. They said, you know, here he is in the jail, in the barracks. Bring him back to the Sanhedrin, and we're going to ambush him. Before he ever makes it to the Sanhedrin, we're going to ambush him, and we're going to kill him. Verse 16, but the son of Paul's sister. Hey, do you know Paul had a sister? I guess he did, because his nephew was the one that helped him out here. Hearing about their ambush, came and entered the barracks and reported it to Paul. Paul called one of the centurions, and he said, take this young man to the commander, because he has something to report to him. So he took him, brought him to the commander, and said, the prisoner Paul called me and asked me to bring this young man to you, because he has something to tell you. The commander took him by the hand, laid him aside, inquired privately, what is it you have to report to me? The Jews, he said, have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the Sanhedrin tomorrow, as though they're going to hold a somewhat more careful inquiry about him. Don't let them persuade you, because there are more than 40 of them lying in ambush, men who have bound themselves under a curse not to eat or drink until they have killed him. Now they are ready, waiting for your consent. So the commander dismissed the young man and instructed him, don't tell anyone that you have informed me about this. So, most of us know the rest of the story, know that they don't kill Paul, right? So are you saying that these 40 guys, did they die of hunger and thirst because they're not able to kill Paul? Well, we have ample evidence from the Jewish writings that sometimes when Jewish vows were taken, they could be released from their vows because of extenuating circumstances. And so the same high priest who collaborated with them could say, I absolve you of your vow, which was a rather rash, hasty vow anyway. But what we see here is the intense hatred that the Jews have of Paul. And you know who this guy was? This is their schoolmate. This is the guy they'd gone to school with. He had been there in Jerusalem in the school of Gamaliel. He'd been the most zealous of all the Jews, and now he's preaching about Jesus. And they hate him so much, they're willing to kill him. But we're going to see that the Lord's assurance is going to come true over the next few chapters as he's going to make it all the way to Rome.